Penguin Random House Audio presents The Maze at Windermere by Gregory Blake Smith. Read for you by Richard Topol, Eduardo Ballerini, Michael Crouch, Raphael Corkill, and Caitlin Davies. What is it then between us? What is the count of the scores or hundreds of years between us? Whatever it is, it avails not. Distance avails not. And place avails not. Walt Whitman. Part 1. Duplicity. Summer, 2011. He was trying to explain to her how he'd gotten to be where he was, the condition he was in, his state of mind, the state of his bank account, his heart, his soul, whatever. They were in the orangery at Windermere, Isha newly naked beside him, the salt air coming in through the window, and this was the sort of moment when he somehow felt compelled to tell all. What had gotten under his skin, he found himself saying, was the way the guy kept bringing up the Tennis Life article. Lacks the killer instinct to break into the top 50, he kept saying, drunk, obnoxious, smiling that smile that men smile to show they're just kidding, even when they're not just kidding. Who was this bozo, anyway? At which Isha leaned over and kissed him like, poor you, her dreadlocks spilling across her lovely shoulders. This had been last August, he told her, a real low point in his life. His knee was shot, and he just retired, or was on the verge of retiring, or wasn't sure whether he was retiring or not, but his right knee was messed up, his life was messed up, his ranking had dropped below 200 for the first time in 8 years, and the only options were to drift back down into the Challenger circuit, or pack it in and try to land a college coaching job, or failing that, a gig at some luxury resort instructing Fortune 500 types on how to hit a slice backhand. Sandy Allison, he imitated the guy, the bozo, the guy with the motorcycle last August. Out of Duke, a great shot maker, but lacks the killer instinct to break into the top 50. Thing was, that past August was the second year running he hadn't qualified for the U.S. Open. It had been the beginning of the end. And even if he had qualified, he wouldn't have been able to play his knee again. So he'd come to Newport to the Hall of Fame Champions Cup as a hitting partner for Todd Martin. A tag-along, a hanger-on, was that his future? His money was beginning to run out, and he knew he had to make a decision, and soon. But in Newport, a little of the old life beckoned, and after the semifinals, he'd gone to the Champions Ball with the idea of catching on with some of the local wealth. This was Newport, he didn't have to remind Isha. But the evening had degenerated from the waltz, to the bossa nova, to the watusi, until the surviving couple dozen partiers, the champions had left a long time ago, had gone off bar-hopping down along Thames Street and ended up at he couldn't even remember where they'd ended up, but the bozo, the guy with the antique motorcycle, just wouldn't let up. What he didn't tell her was how that phrase, lacks the killer instinct, had eaten at him for nearly a decade. It came from a year-end issue of Tennis Life, a future of American tennis sort of thing, about the new crop of guys making the transition to the pro tour. This was back in 2002, and he had just made it, as a freshman no less, to the NCAA semifinals, and some of the things they had to say were cool. They called him the Southern Gentleman, said he had an artistry on the court, was well-liked in the players' lounge. But that last summing up had seemed to doom him to the hinterland of almost but not quite, which, if he was completely honest, was exactly where he'd spent the decade of his pro career. He had, in fact, cracked the top 50. Sandy Allison, 2006, number 47 in the world, you can look it up, had made it once to the third round of Wimbledon, twice to the second round of the U.S. Open, had a dozen Challengers titles to his name, the courts back at his Charleston High School named in his honor, but somehow, none of that was good enough. He was, somehow, in spite of all that, a loser. It didn't matter that in 2006 he could beat all but 46 freaking players in the whole freaking world. It didn't matter that whatever town he drove into, he could beat whoever their best tennis player was. Could beat him left-handed, for Pete's sake, and he could, too. He used to mess around on the court playing left-handed when he should have been doing drills. None of that mattered. He was, even while people wanted to know him, wanted to hang out with him because he was a professional athlete, somehow, he was still a loser. He hadn't been a winner. He lacked the killer instinct. And therefore, he had to be a loser. That was how it felt, anyway. Although he didn't ever tell that to anyone. Certainly not to the woman lying beside him. So yeah, the motorcycle. Maybe all it was just that the guy was a bad drunk. Maybe he was just a bad drunk and it just happened to have been Sandy who had gotten in his way. But the guy started calling shit at him across the room the casino party had settled into, the women in their cocktail dresses and the men in their dinner jackets with their ties undone. It got bad enough that everyone started getting embarrassed for Sandy. The women wouldn't look at him, or they'd shush the bozo. There was this one British woman there who kept saying, "Oh, what rot!" And the men had that look men get when one of them is being singled out, the challenge, the appraisal, the "Are you just going to sit there and take it?" look. Earlier in the evening, the motorcycle guy had been friendly enough. Sandy had stood with him on the sidewalk in front of one of the bars down on Lower Thames Street, and they'd talked tennis. The guy knew who Sandy was, knew his career, had himself played for Williams 20 years earlier, and Sandy had complimented him on his motorcycle parked alongside the curb, an antique red Indian Chief with those deeply valanced fenders and the whole Steve McQueen look. Complimented him not because he cared about motorcycles, but just because he was a nice guy, right? Hadn't tennis life said so? Anyway, inside the bar, it got to a point where Sandy had to answer the guy, had to say something, anything. So he called back over the tables and chairs that separated them. "Dude, I could beat you left-handed." "Dude," the guy had said. "Dude." Like it was the sorriest ass thing anyone could say. And he had this way of spreading his hands about himself, gesturing toward the others as if to include them on his side, as if it was the lot of them who'd paid $1,000 a plate against the tennis pro who lacked the killer instinct. There was no way Sandy could beat him left-handed, the guy said, and when Sandy challenged him again, the guy had said, okay, he was on. One set, Sandy left-handed, him right-handed. He'd put up the Indian. "No Indian," Sandy had said. "We just play." The bozo went, "Pfft." Like, what kind of loser was this? Of course they had to play for something. That's how it was done. "The Indian," he said again. "You were drooling over it an hour ago, pretty boy. It's yours, if you can beat me." He had tried to keep his own nonchalance, but the faces on either side of him began to swim at the edge of his vision. The low-cut necklines, the pearls and spaghetti straps, the men with expressions of wanting to look away. "Lacks the killer instinct," the guy said, and gazed around the room with an easy gesture like, voila. "Okay," Sandy had said. He tried to make his own easy gesture like, "Okay, if that's what you want." The guy turned back to him. "Okay," he mimicked Sandy's accent, making the words sound like it had three syllables. And then, after a few strategic moments had passed, "And what are you putting up, champ?" And that, he told Isha, was when he got it. When he understood. The motorcycle was appraised at 30K, the guy was saying. What was Sandy going to put up against it? He'd walked right into it, he told her. It hadn't been about tennis. It wasn't even the drunk former college player who thought he could have been a pro thing. He'd seen that before. No, this was about something else. "Dude," the guy mocked. He could feel the heat coming into his face. The whole room began to swim. He had enough presence of mind not to smile, but that was about it. "What rot!" the Brit tossed out again. 30K, the guy repeated. "Give or take a couple. I'll accept stocks, bonds, traveler's checks." He was having fun now. "A new bow thruster for my
Sample complete. Ready to continue?